And welcome back. Once again, it's time for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week on the show, well, we can't avoid it, so we're going to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl. And then after that, we're going to move on and talk about, well, we're calling them sacred cows. We're thinking about remakes, reboots, and other attempts to get blood from a turnip. And why sometimes that doesn't make anyone angry, and sometimes it makes everyone angry. And as always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's introduce everybody. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
Ostensibly, I write about books and comic books for the NPR website. Taking a bit of a caesura right now, the fermata, the hiatus.
And I think we would all extend a silky-voiced thanks to Perul Segal for being on the show with us last week.
It was really great. Thank you very much.
I love Perul Segal. I love the part where she replaced the guy who doesn't read.
You know, I
the voice of the internet.
Just because I talk about not reading a lot of books does not actually mean I can't read.
That's true.
Don't read other things.
It's true. It doesn't mean you can't.
Specifically, you read the hurtful comments.
Yeah, that's right.
And you curl up in a corner and
how,
weep.
How much I love Perul.
Anyway, we appreciate it. We'll be sure to have her back as soon as Stephen's ego can take it. So, speaking of Stephen's ego, this weekend, yes. It was the Super Bowl.
It was.
You're sort of my social director for the Super Bowl, Stephen. How'd that go for you?
Well, as we've mentioned on this podcast before, I host a Super Bowl party called the Chicken Bowl,
right.
Which is a grand Super Bowl party / fried chicken eating contest.
Theoretically, yeah. How did it end?
Theoretically.
How did it end? Who won? Well, hardly anybody actually competes. Who won?
It was won by a man named Dave Chernikovsky, who ate 14 pieces of chicken and won all our hearts. Walked away with the priceless Chicken Bowl Championship tiara.
And also the tiara within.
And also the tiara within, which used to be the prize. I used to call it the trophy within,
right.
Until I realized that the trophy within consisted of partially digested fried chicken.
Yeah.
But there was an actual football game that also went on, and New York Giants, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was a team. I kind of blacked out how they got to the Super Bowl, but I gather they beat a team of some renown.
Yeah, they did. So what we were going to do, you know, there's only so much that we can stand around and talk about a football game, considering that we are who we are.
Do you need me to tag out for Mike Pesca?
So we thought that we would cover the Super Bowl in our usual merry fashion by having me ask you a few trivia questions about the Super Bowl. So this is going to be our little quiz for the week. So, well, you know, I'll just do these one at a time. Glenn Weldon, I'll give you this question.
Mm-hmm.
Someone is very unpopular in Boston right now for suggesting after the game that perhaps the fault lay not with the quarterback, but with the receivers. And and this is a semi-famous person under some fire. Any idea?
No idea. Marv Albert?
Anyone else? Steven, you know the answer.
It's Gisele Bündchen.
Oh, yes.
The wife of New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady.
And a supermodel.
And a supermodel. Because Tom Brady's life, he's just slogging through.
It's now, otherwise bad.
There is video of this incident in which essentially what happened is she was walking to the elevator after the game. Terrible disappointment for her husband.
Who has only won 3 Super Bowls out of 5.
In theory, even though they are famous, she still loves him in theory. And and someone yells out some nasty comment about her husband, and she is essentially, she's being followed by a bunch of paparazzi, but she says to her friends, really, I couldn't believe how much they dropped the ball. And then she says this sort of great thing that I kind of agree with, which is, my husband cannot both throw the ball and catch the ball.
Actually, I kind of agree with that, too.
Yeah.
As do 7 out of 10 physicists.
Physics was. And the funny thing is, you know, honestly, she is a quarterback's wife. She should care. She should be, in my opinion, ready to defend him against assaults against his honor.
The other thing, having watched the Packers playoff game against New York, in which the receivers dropped, like, I'm just guessing here, 300 passes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not a completely unreasonable statement for a fan of the football team to make.
Right.
To her friends. She didn't call a press conference.
She didn't. But she was, you know, the press was there and people are saying she should have realized they were going to hear her. It sort of was one of those things where it started off being to her friends and then she also just kind of turned and she was sort of making sure the guy who just yelled at her that her husband is owned by the other. Anyway.
She was cheating the camera. Yeah.
She was a little bit. So, Trey Graham, here is your question.
Yes.
So the Giants, naturally, when they returned to New York, have had their parade. And there were some estimates going around about how much confetti.
Oh, come on.
Because, of course, now they have confetti instead of actual ticker tape.
Right.
How much confetti might be picked up? Now, I haven't seen the final tally.
Is this multiple choice?
No, you have to actually predict the number of pieces of confetti to within five.
No. But what I will ask you is, the last time they had a Giants parade in 2008, I did get the estimate for how many tons of confetti slash paper were picked up after that parade. Now, I'm going to give you four choices. Is it closest to 3 tons, 30 tons, 300 tons, or 3,000 tons?
Well, first of all, is it officially sanctioned government-issued confetti, or people like emptying their shredders?
This is what was picked up. Confetti recovery squad reported.
Now, this may include some corpses.
Yeah. I'm going to say 30 tons.
You are right. The final estimate was 34.2 tons. Now, you might think some of those estimates got a little silly as we went up toward 3,000 tons, but I will tell you that these are nowhere close to the biggest estimates ever for a ticker tape parade in New York, and they noted in this same article from the Associated Press, thank you, Associated Press, that one of the ticker tape parades for John Glenn, back when he was, an astronaut, netted 3,474 tons of ticker tape, and that the ticker tape parade for veterans returning from the war in 1945, they picked up 5,438 tons of ticker tape. Now, of course, presumably it weighed more when it was actual ticker tape.
Sticker tape.
From ticker taping. but nevertheless, 34.2 tons in 2008 for the Giants, so excellent guess, Trey.
Woot.
Stephen Thompson.
Yes.
Here is your trivia question.
I like how you're covering the sheet
Stephen
of paper
Thompson.
With your hands because you think I'm going to cheat and
it's
look.
Time to
I don't.
Lip-sync for your life.
This happens to be how I'm sitting right now.
All right.
So, as you may know, in addition to the wagering that could theoretically go on at Chicken Bowl, there is also wagering on the actual Super Bowl. On the football game.
I did not know. That sullies the big event.
Yeah. So I found an estimate of how much money was bet on the Super Bowl in Nevada casinos, right? Where, of course, this kind of thing is allowed.
Right.
And that's why they don't do it anywhere else.
Right.
People don't do it anywhere else because this is where it's allowed.
Right.
So was the total amount that was bet closer to $90 million?
It's definitely more than that. Go ahead.
$190 million, $290 million, or $390 million?
It's got to be more than, it's got to be $390 million.
At Nevada casinos, $93.9 million.
What?
Wow.
$93.9 million.
Just because they dare not besmirch the integrity of the Super Bowl?
I don't know.
That seems very low to me.
I don't know, buddy. $93.9 million at Nevada casinos.
At least that much was bet at my house for Chicken Bowl.
That's the number.
And just on the outcome of the Chicken Bowl.
How soon can you eat this thigh?
It was just on the wing spread.
That is the number that I found. Now,
the number of calories.
I'm gonna throw out one more little factoid. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be anyone's question, but you can all sort of an estimate. During the Madonna performance at the halftime show, Twitter recorded an average of how many tweets per second?
Oh, I read this statistic and it has already gone out of my head. Darn it.
Anyone? Anyone want to make a
guess? 150,000 per second.
That is entirely too generous.
Okay.
The answer is 8,000 on average, 8,000 tweets per second, and it peaked at 10,245.
Wow.
And one final factoid, more people watched her halftime show than watched the actual game.
Well, isn't that always the case?
I don't think so.
I think it's often the case.
I think more people watched the game the year that Edward James Olmos, and Phil Collins, and the cast of The Lion King performed.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I do want to give us credit on this podcast for something that is very important, which is when we talked about the Tony Awards, we talked about the performance of It's Raining Men, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And we specifically had a conversation about the fact that that sort of thing is so mainstream now.
Yep.
That we literally said, you can make that the Super Bowl halftime show.
Right.
Yeah.
We had that conversation
yep.
this year.
And that's basically
close.
What it was.
Very, very close.
Really,
very close.
Really, really close.
The song that was banned everywhere 25 years ago was the Super Bowl halftime
show. It was very close. You had the shirtlessness. You had the
club Cleopatra dance. Shout out.
To me, it seemed very novel to have homoeroticism in a football stadium.
yeah, that's never happened before.
I can count on the fingers of no hands, how many times the thought has occurred to me, man, I wish I was in a gay bar right now.
Mm-hmm.
happened to me on Sunday night for the first time. It felt like an event. It felt like, not, I don't want to go to like moon landing. It's not like gay moon landing. Not quite there. But it's like it felt like the Oscars. It felt important.
Well, that was the joke that was going around this week is, you know, now that we've had Madonna at the Super Bowl, we can't call the Oscars the gay Super Bowl
it's
anymore.
True.
Because it's been done.
And I will defend the music choices. I know people slag on music, but, you know, it makes the people come together. That's A. B, it's a relic of its time. Yes, it sounds like the 90s, but that's what popular music is supposed to do. It's supposed to be a relic of its time.
Plus, mm-hmm. It's not easy to fit bourgeoisie into a
that's
song.
True. Try it. You can't.
Fitting it into a lyric, not easy. But, you know, it really is true, I think. You know, when I watched that halftime show, I really did think she's still pretty fun to watch.
Oh, I thought that was a really, really fun show.
She's still pretty fun.
God knows she knows how to put on a show.
Yeah.
She does.
Compared to a lot of the sort of stultifying classic rock medleys that they've done in recent years, I thought it was much. It just popped a lot more.
Yeah.
All props to Springsteen sliding toward the camera crotch first.
Yes.
But I would much rather watch CeeLo Green, like, pull the ripcord and turn into the Mother Abbess.
Oh,
you know, because that was kind of awesome.
Well, on the All, they talked about, they did a dialogue between Julie Klausner and Natasha Vargas Cooper, where they mentioned something she did three times in that thing, which wasn't stumble. She only did that once. She smiled. Madonna smiled. Now, Cher, we are used to seeing some kind of sense of humor from. She does irony. She does sarcasm. She is part of the enormous decades-long joke that is Cher. She's in it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Madonna is not. Madonna shows very little.
Historically has not been.
Whenever you see her, you don't see a performer enjoying herself. You see sort of a grim determination. It's like,
you see a performer working really
right.
hard.
Yeah,
you see her selling.
Yes. selling the sexy, selling the hard.
Really hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not enjoying it. And so to see her smile was sort of a revelation.
There was warmth to that performance. It sounds like a strange thing to add, but you know, what she was wearing was not so severe looking as what she sometimes has worn in major public performances. The headdress was kind of whimsical that she had at the beginning. And when she took the headdress off, the dress that she was wearing was kind of just a flouncy black dress.
Yeah,
she was mostly pretty covered up. It was a sort of active, dancey kind of little dress.
And given how hard she worked, because she did like a little headstand, little thing, a little cartwheel, whatever, I'm sure the thing that she wanted to be reading the next morning were headlines about some 27-year-old pisher who showed a finger.
Talk about a sense of humor.
There were some really interesting discussions the next day about whether it was sort of more obnoxious to spend a lot of time focusing on how offensive that was, or whether it was
we're talking about MIA flipping the bird.
Yes. Whether it was more offensive to do it in the first place, not because it's so offensive, but because it's so tiresome. Seriously. Like, it's such a dumb sort of, I don't know. It seemed really weak to me. Like, I mean, especially when you're up there with Madonna, who really genuinely has been at times challenging to various norms and has actually managed to make people uncomfortable, as I learned when I wrote about her. It was interesting to be like, now I will give the finger and be all transgressive. Like, I don't know. It was kind of, but anyway.
Well, it is one of those things where it's like, if you really want to like stick it to the man at the Super Bowl halftime show, don't perform at the Super Bowl halftime show.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. I always feel that way. All right.
Return to the Ricky Gervais axiom.
Exactly. Well, you can, as always, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. And you can share, you know, a Super Bowl fact, a Super Bowl reflection. What did you think of Madonna? Who were you rooting for? Free Gisele Bündchen? Whatever your particular point.
Did you, in fact, squeal when you saw the Cleopatra barge?
No.
No.
Yeah, the dudes, maybe.
I kind of did.
Might be a trick question.
Anyway, so I was busy writing about Madonna. But also in the last week, Glenn missed a magic opportunity to write about something that you may have heard about, which was the decision to release more books about Watchmen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Explain this project a little bit.
Many years ago, in 1986.
The year
1986.
Exactly. DC Comics bought a company called Charlton and their heroes, their line of heroes. And they decided that they wanted to bring those heroes into the DC universe. So Alan Moore, famous weird writer guy, Alan Moore, decided that he would write a pitch. The editors at DC looked at this pitch and said, you know what, this is going to make all these wonderful characters we just acquired. You've killed off some of them. You've permanently done things that will make them unusable. So why don't you just go off and write something else that follows the same plot, but just make up your own characters.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. That was Watchmen, which was a 12-issue miniseries, which deconstructs the genre of superheroes, bloody, blah, blah. Great book. One of the most popular graphic novels of all time. when Alan Moore wrote that book, the deal he had in mind, and the deal he had with DC was, he will own these characters as soon as the book goes out of print, as soon as these comics go out of print. Alan Moore was very happy with that because, you know, he wanted some ownership of this.
Sure.
Of course, it being one of the most popular graphic novels of all time, it is not gone out of print.
And it's not that hard to keep a book in print.
Exactly. Yeah. And effectively, it will never go out of print. Yeah. So he never got the money, especially now. Yeah. So this caused him, also this and the same kind of thing happened with V for Vendetta, caused him to sever all ties with DC Comics, and now he is a famous grump with, you know, every reason to be. I mean, he's out there, and he's very vocal about not wanting to have anything to do with this property. In the years that have passed, this project has gotten deified. He originally had an idea for an earlier book that would follow, it was called Minutemen. It was a sequel, actually. It would be a prequel. He decided it really didn't, he and Dave Gibbons, the artist, decided that it wouldn't really go anywhere, so he didn't do it. Well, the only thing that has been keeping DC Comics from doing anything with these characters is their integrity.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
And after 25 years, integrity sort of wears away. So as of this spring and summer, they're coming out with a line of books called Before Watchmen, which take all these characters, and they've assigned them to different artists.
Wait, Watchmen babies.
Watchmen babies. Lil Watchmen. This has caused a lot of hue and cry because people feel that this is a sacred cow that we cannot touch. My own feeling is, if you look at the lineup of the people they got to write these things, I mean, there's Darwin Cook, there's Amanda Connor, there's some really good artists there. Yeah. Will it be as good as Watchmen? No. But that's kind of beside the point. I mean, I am more bemused by this. I've always felt it was inevitable. I always felt it was only a matter of time before this happens, because the only thing that's stopping, there's money to be made here, and they own these characters for better or for worse.
Right.
So, yes, they can do it. I think this is my feeling for all this sacred cow kind of discussion. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and do it. We will judge it. And if it sucks, I mean, this is, it feels like the invisible hand of the marketplace, you know, what the market will bear. But I really believe it. I really believe that, okay, if it sucks, it sucks.
Mark Hirsch wrote about this for Monkey See. And the question that I had put to him, which he quoted me as putting to him in the piece because he thought it was terribly, terribly funny, was, why is it okay to have a million versions of Batman, but this one, people get all upset. I feel like I have been trained by you, Glenn Weldon, to understand that this is what they do. They reboot them. They start them over. They tell a whole new story. They take the same character, start all over. Sometimes you might like this Batman. You might not like this Batman. But this seemed to send people into this sort of like, how dare you, sir?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Mark explained it was very much the way you explained it, that it had begun as a sort of a whole, and that it was not intended, you know, the whole point of it was to make one whole and allow it to be a story where you would not have to reuse the character.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you hear these discussions, the sacred cow discussion, it always comes back to people saying, but Alan Moore's not involved. It's not the creator's work. I don't like somebody else messing with the creator's vision.
Yeah.
But that's clearly not the criteria, because tell that to George Lucas, who is equally hated, if not much more hated, and here's another reason this is good to talk about this week, endlessly hated for what he does with his own work, including the 3D re-releases of the Star Wars movies that are starting to come out this week.
Yeah. It occurs to me, too, that this isn't just a comic books thing, obviously, as you were beginning to suggest with the George Lucas thing. You've got characters like Sherlock Holmes and Dracula who get reimagined all the time. Uh-huh. Which isn't to say that they don't inspire a similar kind of loyalty. The fans of these characters are legion and passionate, right? So where's the dividing line for people, do you think?
Well, one thing that I would throw out there is sort of the issue of, what type of creator are we talking about? George Lucas is somewhat of a special case just because he's constantly ruining his own work.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a sort of eccentric genius auteur type person is more likely to create a work that is deemed no one else can touch that.
Right. Idiosyncratic.
Idiosyncratic. And basically, when I was thinking about the idea of sacred cows and sort of what can be touched, what can't be touched, a lot of the stuff that I was thinking of that can't be touched is either stuff that people take incredibly personally. You know, whether it is someone's incredibly esoteric vision or a film where people deeply, deeply, deeply relate to the actors.
Right.
So I was thinking about, for example, we've talked in recent weeks about Stand By Me or The Princess Bride. You know, part of it is that they're movies sort of from our, you know, on this particular table from our youth. But it's also some performances and people that we kind of take personally. As opposed, for example, there was a very, very successful reboot of The Karate Kid, which I feel like you don't necessarily have, you know, nobody can top the incomparable Ralph Macchio and this and this incredibly personal vision of this movie, even though we all, or at least I, like, had a real, you know, have a real, like, oh, I love The Karate Kid. Oh, but he kicked him in the, oh, it's awesome. But it's not necessarily that is an untouchable, eccentric universe created by this madman.
Yeah. One of the notes I made was, you know, there have been 1,100 Jane Eyres and several dozen Pride and Prejudices, but so far there's just one set of Godfather movies, and I think that's exactly what you're talking about. The movies have eclipsed the books, the source material, to the point that our understanding of that story is completely defined by those specific actors and their specific performances.
Yeah, there's been an interesting little thing going on recently where the FX series Justified is based on this character that was created by Omar Leonard, but he never really built that character out as much as they have in the show. And in fact, now has written a book in which I, you know, my understanding has been that really he's picking up a lot of what they did in the show to build the book.
Right.
In other words, it's become a very much a circle. Mm-hmm. When he would come and talk to the press about the show, it was always like he didn't feel like he really needed to do the show. He trusted and liked the people who were doing the show. And it wasn't like he was saying, like, they're awesome, this feels like my work. It was more like, this feels like a normal thing to do. And he has been very, you know, open about saying certain adaptations of his stuff he's really liked, other ones he hasn't really liked. But to me, it's a really interesting example of sort of, if you have really good people working on a different imagination of your character, you can actually get into a feedback loop. You know, obviously what's been done with James Bond is beyond just what was in the books. There are different elements and aspects to what's been done with James Bond.
Now he's basically a vague concept.
Right, exactly. And you can kind of, I think he's become a character that you can much more write on in different ways. Like, now people ask all the time, like, why isn't Idris Elba James Bond? And people say, like, now you could probably do that.
You could do that.
You
now,
could probably go different, you
this,
know.
This gets to another idea that I've been turning over my head. I think it's one thing for a pop culture fixture to be fiercely popular in the way that Watchmen is, especially if that fierce popularity is in a relatively narrow segment of the population. I think it's another thing entirely for a pop culture fixture to be outright totemic, which is where I think you get into the James Bonds and the Sherlocks and the Draculas and all of that. I think it's easier to make endless movies with those characters precisely because they're totemic. They transcend the specifics of the original work. And I think this is not so much the case with characters like Scarlett O'Hara. I don't think she works outside the frame of that original movie.
Not that it wasn't done.
Same. Yeah. Well, they made a sequel to the book. Can you imagine trying to remake that movie?
Yes. It's inevitable.
No. I'm going to argue the same thing for Luke and Leia. No matter how much Lucas goes back and tweaks it, you never want to see that movie remade.
I don't know, man. Jar Jar Binks really pops off the screen in 3D.
It's not about want to. I think, like Glenn says, it's about inevitability. And I think if you think about something like Gone with the Wind, I do feel like there is an inevitability to the idea that eventually people want, you know, their own version of things, which takes me to sort of one of my theories about how this kind of thing works with sacred cows. And I could be wrong, certainly. But my guess is that if you plotted out how offended and bothered people are by the idea of different things being remade, rebooted, reimagined, you would find that it peaks with anything that they fell in love with between the ages of 12
and
17.
12 and 17.
So right.
If you are between 12 and 17 when you fell in love with it, it is much more important to you that nobody mess with it. That's why people my approximate age can even be that way about stuff like Footloose.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which, again, as Stephen said about The Karate Kid, it's not like people are saying, like, no one could match the absolutely unbelievable quality of Footloose. And yet, it still feels like, oh, what? Stephen, do you remember what you once said you could not believe had not been remade?
I don't remember. It was 95% of the things I said.
It was during a discussion of WALL-E, and I believe. And
I know what we're going for.
Said that you could not believe that they had not remade Short Circuit.
Yep.
Yes, seriously.
Guess what just happened?
Wait, is there a Broadway adaptation?
There is a pending movie remake of Short Circuit produced by some of the talent that brought you Hop and Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Yes. Awesome.
Nice. So, yeah, I went today and I was sort of looking up current news about remakes. And just looking at current news, there's a new version of Dallas being made. Blue Lagoon, Blade Runner, Judge Dredd, Evil Dead, Short Circuit, 21 Jump Street, of course, Spider-Man, Bourne movies, Avengers, Mission Impossible, You know, Batman, Men in Black.
Wow.
Well, and that's just movies.
That touches on the classic geek response, which is, don't touch this. You're ruining my childhood. my response, whenever everybody says, they shouldn't touch that, my response is, they're not. It's still there. This is the conversation I had with a friend of mine over, who enters every conversation we have with the premise, Disney is evil. Everything Disney does is evil. Therefore, the line in the sand she would not accept was when they remade The Hunchback of Notre Dame. What a wonderful novel.
As a musical.
And now, no one will read, children will not get grow up reading that book. As if they're growing up reading the book.
Yeah, seriously.
And of course,
children will stop reading.
Right, and they're going to think it's all about dancing gargoyles. And of course, she's right, because as we all know, in the years since that movie came out, The Hunchback of Notre Dame has gone out of print. And The Hunchback of Notre Dame is the most popular Disney film of all time, and there's a line around the block at Disney World to get your picture with Quasimodo.
Right.
I was trying to think, what can't you remake? Mm-hmm. And what I come back to again and again are spectacular failures that have salted the earth in such a way that you can never go back to, and the movie that jumps out immediately, Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
Can't make Howard the Duck.
Certain, it's poison.
Certain franchises have been ruined forever by catastrophic attempts to turn them into franchises.
Cursed.
I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a 1992 film with Christy Swanson was not a blockbuster, but it was not, oh my God, you can never ever go back to that character. Battlefield Earth is kind of its own thing. But I think if your movie remake of something, if your very high profile, spectacular, calamitous disaster can completely rebrand a franchise in such a way that it can never be touched
again. You don't think
again.
They can remake The Postman?
Oh, yeah.
Postman! I said ride!
Not to pile on, but Waterworld.
Yeah, sure. You know,
Bonfire of the Vanities.
And I feel like we should just mention that there was, in the works for a while, another TV series about Buffy the Vampire Slayer that was Whedon-less. It got a huge response from the Whedon community of how dare they? Well, they dare. That's kind of the idea.
They often dare.
They often dare, and in this case, they chose to dare not, and they backed out. But, I mean, even if they made it, you still have Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You still have, I was going to say, 7 good seasons. You got 5 good seasons. You got 4.5 good seasons.
Well, that's how I feel about the fact that they can make it, and you can not watch it.
Right.
And, in fact, one of your reasons for not watching it can be, I don't want to confuse my brain with other versions of things that I already like.
Yep.
It used to be that sequels were a kind of respected option for things that seemed to call for them. And obviously...
Well, there's the rub.
Well, and it's... Right. And it's tough to talk about something like The Godfather because you have a novel and all that stuff. But there used to be certain things where it would be like, it would make sense to do another Indiana Jones movie. Now, it's almost like if you make a movie, there was this recent controversy about Kristen Wiig saying she didn't really want to make a Bridesmaids 2. There was sort of a controversy where it sort of felt like, well, what do you have against your fans? Like, why aren't you giving the people what they want? It really does feel like there was a certain amount of, like, she's an ungrateful
wretch. And
to me, it's shocking to me that you can't, as the person who wrote something, you can't legitimately say, that's the story.
Right, I think I'm done.
Well, and then you have these franchises like The Hangover 2, where there was clearly a great financial call for a second Hangover movie, and it was certainly financially successful, but they basically were like, here you go, here it is again.
Right, yep.
Yeah, here's the same movie twice.
And they're doing
it. There's going to be a third. What Linda was saying plugs into some of the same impulses, some of the same fan greed, I think, that we've talked about earlier in the context of shipping and of not wanting a TV series to end, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah. There's this inability to let the story be the story. I think it's true with certain TV shows. It's true with certain movies that the story is the story. If you tell a story in a complete structured way, you can't just necessarily just tell another one. It's not like, you know, why didn't you ever write, well, I was going to say Hamlet too, but...
Highly recommended if you haven't seen
it. Yeah, that's
very funny. Yeah, that was going to say. I stumbled right into that. But, yep. I mean, there is a reason why not everything is supposed to have a sequel
I think one of the turning points, I think, is have you as a writer established a universe that is singular enough to support further exploration? And as good as Bridesmaids is... It's set in an ordinary place with people we recognize. It's not a new universe that, you know, another writer could come in and richly explore.
Right.
Which is not necessarily the case.
Like, who were the other people getting married
Watchmen,
at this country
instance.
Club at the same time?
Right.
Like, I mean, in a way, certain kinds of sequels really are more like remakes. Mm-hmm. Like, The Hangover 2 is more of a remake, of The Hangover. Yeah. It probably is more similar to The Hangover than many remakes are to their original source material. So it's really just a remake of the movie. You change the setting a little bit, you know, but you could
all
get
the
away
story
with,
beats are the same.
You could get away with
if you loved The Hangover but wish it were worse.
Yeah. I mean, you could really get away with just calling that a remake, and in fact, it's a remake with the same actors.
Right. Mm-hmm. I was going to make a comparison earlier when I was talking about the Jane Eyres and the Pride and Prejudices and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I had a thought that I was going to finish by saying, but there's only ever been one Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. It turns out there wasn't. There was a remake. was a TV remake starring the sisters Redgrave. Back in the 90s, I think.
So
talk about your bad ideas.
Well, I do have to say one more thing, which is it's also very appropriate that this conversation is happening on the day that I got the press release that Tooth Fairy 2, going direct to video, will star Larry the Cable Guy.
Of course it
Absolutely
will.
Absolutely true.
I like Larry the Cable Guy is the poor man's The Rock.
I guess.
So what is sacred?
I can't think of a thing. Like, when we were coming up with this topic, Trey mentioned something obviously like Gone with the Wind, and my first instinct was, of course not. So I don't think there is anything sacred. I think
you can
do whatever you want.
I have two that are absolutely sacred.
All right. Shoot.
Lawrence of Arabia. You try to make Lawrence of Arabia, first you go bankrupt, and then I come and kill you. Secondly, Birth of a Nation.
Well, okay.
That's a little different.
Fine.
That's a little different.
It's a different one.
We remade it. Now it's a musical comedy. I have the sort of the same reaction that I don't consider anything really to be sacred in terms of you can't make it. But there are definitely things that feel completely unnecessary. I think that's as far as I go.
Ill-advised.
That's as far as I go. I'll definitely go as far as ill-advised and unnecessary.
If I could abuse the metaphor, so you got a sacred cow, you're not making steak out of it, you're just getting some milk.
Wow.
I'm stunned. I'm floored.
We're stunned into silence, and this is where the segment has to end.
I'm flattened by your genius.
That's a very moving metaphor.
Oh, cripes.
Glenn started it. So come to our Facebook page, as I mentioned earlier, or come to the blog at Monkey Sea, which is at npr.org/Monkey Sea. And you can find, we always have a blog post about the podcast. You can come and you can comment and you can chit chat. If you don't like Facebook, find us on the blog. We read comments there as well. And that brings us to our final segment of the week. What is making you happy this week? This is my favorite part of the show. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
It turns out if you're sick in bed and you're hopped up on NyQuil,
theoretically,
you need to see a bad movie. Which bad movie should you pick? Well, I have a suggestion. I have heard for years about a film called The Happening by M. Night Shyamalan. I'm not a big horror guy, so I never saw it. But people keep saying this is a bad movie. I was unprepared for this film. This is flatly asserted, flatly acted, flatly written, ham-fisted. And every time Mark Wahlberg was on the screen, on his face throughout this film, which is about a series of gory mass suicides which may represent the extinction of the human race, Mark Wahlberg had an expression on his face like he was a man trying to calculate the tip.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of looking off, sort of squinting, 18, 20, well, she knew my name.
What he was calculating is the paycheck he was getting for this movie.
Whenever that happened, I had this thought, I always want to be watching this movie. I never want to not be watching this movie.
Because it's such a joy.
It is goofy, and it is inept. And the ineptitude of it is really what is endearing. There's a thing called dailies, you know? You can take a look at the film you're shooting and go, this isn't working.
Stop making that face, Zooey Deschanel.
Exactly. But apparently,
that's her face.
Like, the universe is big enough that somebody would write this film, begin to film it, and continue filming it.
Here's what you should know. Two things that you should know. One is that I have said many times, and I think I mentioned to you on Twitter, the absolute best part of that movie is where he's watching the videotape of the lions or whatever it is tearing the arms off the guy. They're all thinking that it's a terrorist attack for some reason. And so they rip off the arms, and then somebody says, "What kind of terrorists are these?" Because they have made a lion rip off a person's arms.
The bad kind.
So that's A. B is, long ago, before I worked steadily at NPR, I worked for Vulture. I used to write for Vulture, the blog at New York Magazine. And we got a hold of a working script, the old working script.
When it was called The Green Effect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I wrote a post about it, which I should dig up for you.
Yeah, please.
Because here's the thing. It was worse.
Yeah.
It was worse. And the end was quite different. It had a lot more like, we have to talk about how much we love each other and only that will see us through the plant invasion. It really is.
Wait, was that a spoiler?
No. It was about the plants.
They tell you this is the
it's
thing.
There's endless
news reports where the entire thing is explained in a way that it would not get explained by anyone ever.
Anyway, I firmly agree with you, Glenn.
If you haven't seen this film, you think you know what you're in for. You do not know what you're in for.
It is a great joy. Just thinking about it makes me happy.
Oh, good.
Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, funny that you should mention explaining, because that is one of the things that is called out in a delightful little exercise called the Smash Abridged script, which we're passing around the office today. It is a sort of snarky deconstruction of everything that is wrong with the first episode of Smash on NBC, which you may have heard us talk about last week.
Trey likes. I do kind of like,
but I recognize its weaknesses. There is a delightful moment where Catherine McPhee and her handsome, supportive boyfriend are sitting in a restaurant, and she is telling him many things about her life, and he responds, instead of with the dialogue in the that's in the actual show, he responds by saying, "I know this. I know this. I know this.
Why are you telling me this?
And then her last response is, because the Peabody Award-winning writer has no concept of how to deal with exposition.
It is a very exposition-y scene.
Yes, it is. This Smash Abridged script refers to Deborah Messing simply as "and Grace," because once again, she's been saddled with the gay sidekick. There are several other small things making me happy this week. Glenn Weldon's super-powered pajamas, which made my eyes bleed when he posted a picture of them on Twitter,
but presumably
made him feel better.
They did. Plus two on constitution.
His yes.
Like an up the nerdery even more.
There was a brief moment toward the end of the hour-long interview with Meryl Streep on Fresh Air where Terry Gross had to push the bleep button on Meryl Streep. I encourage you to listen to that interview because it's truly awesome, and it is great fun. Harlan Ellison's Pay the Writer rant on YouTube. It's from at least 5 years ago, but it surfaced again today in a couple of circles that I move in, and it is profanely awesome. It doesn't actually say much that's brand new. It's just this kind of famous guy who's outraged at the idea that the major movie studio he's working for doesn't think his contributions are worth as much as the time of the person who's being paid to call him and ask him to work for free. And he basically says that to them.
Just
kind of
put a nickel in that guy.
Right?
I love Harlan Ellison.
And finally, the announcement today that the old post office building here in Washington, D.C. is going to become a Trump hotel. They have signed a development deal with Trump Hotels. Why am I happy about this, you ask? Because it means that with any luck, Washingtonians, like you and me, will get the chance to offer a Bronx cheer in person when the deal goes bad.
Fair enough. Very good choices, Trey Graham. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I don't have as many as Trey. I'm going to more or less punt this one. I'm going to be live tweeting this weekend's Daddy-Daughter Dance, for which I have to skip a concert by artists who have put out two of my favorite albums of this year, Sharon Van Etten and Shearwater. If you have not heard the albums by Sharon Van Etten and Shearwater, at least one of them is streaming on the NPR site right now. But I will be missing their concert so that I may go to the Daddy-Daughter Dance. I will, however, briefly bring in a guest.
So that
someone else may let the world know what is making her happy, because part of what is making me happy, the sort of thing that that I cannot recommend because it can't really be shared with others all that much, is a visit from my dear mother.
Maggie has fans. We can share
and
that
the
with
The only
people.
Way that I can really share the joy that is my mother with the public is by putting her on mic.
Maggie Thompson, welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Hey, Maggie
Thompson.
Thrilled
to be here. And welcome back to town.
Yes.
And we didn't make you talk about Watchmen and comics, so but we appreciate the fact that you sat in the corner of the room making us feel like we had to get everything exactly right.
Yeah.
Maggie Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, attending a chicken bowl, my first chicken bowl in Maryland was outstanding.
Yes.
Getting to see my grandkids again. Outstanding. Getting to hang out with my son. Outstanding. Cleaning up after chicken bowl was even fun.
Yeah.
The thing that may be making me happy, aside from all the family joy, is that a book that was my idea is going to the printer next week.
That's always exciting.
That's always
and
a good thing.
Yes. So, Glenn, mark your calendar. It gets very exciting when you finished the job.
Yeah.
The book will be coming out in May. It was my idea, but I did not write it. It's called A Parent's Guide to the Best Kids Comics.
Oh, we have some people who have asked for this.
This is what I get asked for the most. This is a great thing.
And it was what I got asked for, too. And I am not the expert.
Yeah.
I am an expert in comics. I haven't got a clue in this regard, nor do I have the credentials. So we found a couple of librarian types. You'll be amazed.
Oh, librarians. We like them.
Oh, librarians.
It's the dog whistle of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
And the plan is that there is a cover image, a sample page from each of these. They're all books, not periodicals. And we have things like ISBN numbers and prices and samples so that a parent can glance at it and go, ew, I don't like that at all. Or, woohoo, that's cool.
And show it to your kids and then they'll want to buy everything.
Yep. Exactly.
I have seen some pages from this book. It looks wonderful.
It looks great. This is desperately needed and it's going to be great.
There we are. How can I be happier than
just
this?
Just dreaming about it is making us happy this week. Thank you, Maggie Thompson. We're always very happy to have you on the show.
It was delightful.
Well, one thing making me happy is a reminder that giving oneself credit is hereditary.
Oh, God.
All right. Well, I have one quick thing. I, too, attended Chicken Bowl, and I had great success with everything that I baked for Chicken Bowl.
That's right.
To the point where I gave myself whisking elbow with all the – I made some brownies and some blondies. I followed the best idea ever, which I got from the internet, which is corn dog mini muffins. And I tweeted the link to the recipe. It is just make some cornbread batter, put it in a mini muffin pan, and in each little mini muffin, you put a little piece of hot dog. It is the best idea.
It was seriously, they were like gone before the chicken got there.
They were vacuumed up.
In fact, so what Stephen Thompson means to say is that he ate about 12 of them before anyone else arrived.
He did start eating them.
I neither confirm nor deny.
He did start eating them as soon as I took the wrap off of them. It was pretty crazy.
But, we will post that recipe.
I will absolutely give you the link again. It's wonderful. And the woman who posted that recipe, where I got it from, is a woman who tweets as Iowa Girl Eats. She is an Iowa girl, so Midwestern.
Good people.
Figures.
Hey, Linda.
Corn, pork.
Between your whisking elbow and your hacking cough and your bloody eyeball, can we just have a new segment about Linda's ailment?
No.
Okay.
We cannot. The real thing making me happy this week is that I did a shocking thing and betrayed Stephen yesterday. And stopped watching The Bachelor partway through.
Wow.
And switched over to The Voice because everyone kept telling me last time The Voice was on, you gotta watch The Voice. And I didn't. And so I really had not seen very much of it. And I tuned in and I watched The Voice last night. It was a much better choice than The Bachelor. It is a genuinely fun, great show. The judges are awesome. Everybody is like much more appealing than American Idol or any of those. You get the impression that a person who does not look like an American Idol contestant could theoretically go far, as opposed to all the American Idol contestants who generally fit into one of about three categories that American Idol picks people in. It was delightful. Everyone was right. I love it when everyone gave me a recommendation and it was exactly right.
You know, as the one person who is not entirely delighted by this development, I just want to point out,
I know,
that someone guilt-tripped me into continuing to watch The Bachelor, and now I'm continuing to watch The Bachelor without the support of Linda Holmes, and I can offer the commentary that Ben is kind of a pud.
Yes, he really is. And that's kind of why I stopped watching it, and I will probably catch up on Hulu, and, you know, I can keep myself up to date. But in terms of the day-to-day, you got your CeeLo Green, you got Christina Aguilera, you got your Blake Shelton, and you got your, Adam Levine. They are great.
Who is not as bad as you might think.
This is the thing. This is the conversation I was having with somebody last night. Like, he has made a big career out of music that's not that good. He knows something.
Well, this is the thing. I actually saw the one after the Super Bowl because I couldn't get up from the couch because the NyQuil. And I responded to exactly what you did, which is the camaraderie between the judges.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something going on there that doesn't feel forced, doesn't feel like they're just hiding behind giant bottles of Pepsi or whatever.
It doesn't feel like it's actually hostile.
Yeah.
But they have a really nice banter between them. They're sort of competitive, but not really.
It's almost like they're drinking a lot in the green room before the show, right?
I wouldn't put it past it.
They are very nice to watch. It's a really nice rhythm, and you should be watching this show, Stephen.
All right. I hereby pledge to watch The Voice, and we'll talk about it. I'd kind of given up all singing shows when I left Idol.
You're going to love it. And that, speaking of you're going to love it, brings us to the end of our show. You're going to love it.
Yeah.
You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. I say that more forcefully every week. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. It's Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. You can also, as we all do, follow the lead of Stephen's mother by following her on Twitter at Thompson Maggie. That's Thompson Maggie. Don't flip it around. Don't flip it around.
That only chaos would ensue.
Only chaos would ensue. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music.
Which is kicky.
Trey misses it. So thanks to all of you guys for being here as always, and thank you for bringing your mom, Stephen.
Of course.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.